Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. When you think about it, a lot of great music has come from people working in pairs. Carole King and Jerry Goffin have been in the news recently, what with Goffin's recent passing, and King, of course, being the subject of the hit Broadway musical Beautiful. But think of some of the other great musical pairs. Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, Robert Plant and Jimmy Page, Lieber and Stoller, and, of course, Lennon-McCartney. A new book looks at how the dynamic between two people can produce amazing art. And as if to prove the point, our live band today, the Rosebuds, is built around a creative duo. You'll meet them and hear them play live. But first, it's time for us to continue with our week-long series, How to Be Smarter About...
I am too smart! S-M-R-T! I mean S-M-A-R-T!
Damn it, you have to be smarter than that.
Pretty smart, huh?
Pretty smart.
By the way, my name is Smarty Pants.
So, you bought tickets to a big rock show. You get to the theater, buy your outrageously overpriced beer, the band gets on stage, and you have a great time. End of story, right? But what happens before the band even gets there? Who's in charge of making sure they stay there to do the show? Well, today, we're going to find out. Jack McFadden is a talent buyer for Austin City Limits Live and the concert venue known as the Belmont in Austin, Texas. He also spent many years booking bands here in New York. He joins us on the line from Austin to tell us how to be smarter about tour riders. Hi, Jack. Welcome to Soundcheck.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, first of all, explain two things. What is a talent buyer and what is a tour rider?
A talent buyer books the shows. It's that simple.
Okay.
It's kind of a more corporate name for someone who books a club. And the rider is, there's a technical rider and there is a hospitality rider.
So these are part of the contract that you enter into with the artist.
It definitely is. It is. There's, it can be as elaborate as 40 to 50 pages. It can be as simple as one page, but it definitely is part of the contract.
And what is the point of the technical and the hospitality tour rider?
Well, I think it's for from load in to load out, there's no surprises. So The venue is prepared and the band is prepared. What the agent will do is once we book the concert, they'll send us the riders to make sure that we understand where the band is coming from. And, you know, these bands are on the road all the time, and so... You know, there are many villages. I mean, we just did a show with Counting Crows, and there's 40 people on the road with them. So we're kind of their, you know, home base, and we're feeding them, you know, maybe three meals a day, and they're here on the premises for several hours. So we want to take care of them and make sure that they have what they need. Right.
So if one person is vegetarian, another person's vegan, another person's gluten-free, another person keeps kosher.
It'll be there right on the rider.
It'll be in the rider. And it's your job to keep the artists happy so that they actually show up on stage when they're contracted to. Some of these riders have become famous because it's like, you know, lifestyles of the rich and famous. I mean, we had a very big band that performed downstairs in our venue, the Green Space, and let me read you some of what they requested in their rider. And this is not particularly outrageous. Tea service with hot water, 48 cold bottles of quality premium beer, 50 drink tickets, 2 bottles of red wine, 4 cans of Red Bull, not sugar-free, 1 bag of tortilla chips with salsa, extra points for good salsa instead of national brand, 4 cartons of coconut water, 1 copy of the New York Times, 1 block of Gruyere cheese, 1 pack of Camel Light cigarettes, and 12 large clean bath towels. How does that sound to you? That fairly typical?
That sounds easy. That's a good one. That's a dream come true, that one.
So do you see a lot of the same things on these riders?
Like I said, you have different personalities with different needs, and the more people on the road, the more complicated it gets. But you're reading a hospitality writer, and you can see, okay, no paper plates, no plastic cutlery, and that's fine. But when you call also the tour manager a week or two out of the date, he'll give you the scoop.
Right.
You know, we don't need the chunky peanut butter. That guy's not in the band anymore. These riders are written maybe once before a tour, but maybe once every 4 or 5 years for these bands.
Yeah.
So sometimes they're not relevant.
Well, I have to say, the one very big band whose tour rider I just read to you, they were completely fine with, like, whatever we happened to have lying around backstage. So,
exactly.
So someone as big as Adele is apparently not hard to keep happy. Her rider requires 2 bottles of the very best quality red wine and 12 bottles of, and I'll quote here, best quality European lager beer, i.e. Beck's, Stella Artois, Peroni, etc. Now, whether that's best quality European lager is very much open to debate, but North American beer is not acceptable to Adele.
Don't you remember?
Jack McFadden's on the line with us from Austin. He's a talent buyer for Austin City Limits Live and the concert venue known as the Belmont there in Austin, Texas. And this is part of our How to Be Smarter About Music Week on Soundcheck. And today we're talking about tour riders, the addenda, that's the plural of addendum, isn't it? The addenda to a standard concert contract that has all your technical needs and your hospitality needs. Jack, you were talking about how, you know, somebody might require a specific bottle of wine, but if you know something better, they're really happy to get that. Reminds me that, you know, we will often get technical riders. You know, the artist insists on this kind of microphone and this model of microphone. We have an amazing collection of microphones here, and very often bands will come in, see what we have, and, the technical rider gets torn up and thrown out the window because they're delighted to have what we've got here in the studio. But the hospitality rider is a thing that people talk about. Now, I want to play something for you, Jack. This is a couple of weeks ago, our friends over at Freakonomics Radio talked to a bunch of people involved with one of the most famous tour riders of all time. Take a listen. The first voice you're going to hear is that of Freakonomics host and author Stephen Dubner.
By the early 1980s, Van Halen had become one of the biggest rock bands in history. It had these extravagant live shows with a huge stage set, booming audio, spectacular lighting effects. Their contract carried a 53-page rider that laid out the technical requirements for all of this, as well as other demands.
You know, it lists all kinds of food that they want.
Mike Peden worked for a concert promoter in Syracuse, New York.
Some of the strange ones, you know, various donuts, a dozen hard-boiled eggs. They want Fruit Loops and Raisin Bran. They want real knives and forks. They don't want plastic ones.
Patrick Whitley was Van Halen's production manager at the time, which means he was responsible for that contract writer.
And I think I actually typed that sheet. So
It looks like an IBM Selectric, maybe.
Yeah,
is that what you owned?
Yeah, probably was.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then I really love that you made sure you got your vegetables, or you made sure that somebody got their vegetables. Even days, there were Brussels sprouts, broccoli, cauliflower, mushrooms, spinach, and then odd days, peas, green beans, corn, carrots, and tomatoes. And on it goes. You needed some whiskey and beer and wine, I gather, yes?
Of course.
Some KY jelly. What's that for?
For fun.
There was also a section for munchies. Here's Mike Peden again.
Potato chips with assorted dips, nuts, pretzels.
And in the middle of the munchies section,
M&Ms, and then in capital letters and underlined and in parentheses, it says, warning, absolutely no brown ones.
So that is one of the most famous, you know, elements of a tour rider. People talk about the brown M&Ms. Jack, have you what's the most absurd request that you've encountered in a tour rider?
Absurd. Well, I mean, it always amazes me when we get requests for socks, clean socks. And I get it because I've been out on the road with bands, but it still, it just confuses me because, you know, that's socks. Okay. Every time I see socks come up, I my head almost pops off. I can't wrap my head around it.
Now, back in the 80s when this Van Halen tour rider was touring around with the band, you know, it was a little bit of a different time. Do you see a lot of requests for KY jelly these days on tour riders?
You know, I guess the 80s are over. Not KY, no. It's more like Annie Chun's wasabi seaweed snacks.
Very nice. What happens if these demands are not met? Have you ever seen an artist walk out because the wrong brand of bottled water was in the green room?
Not specifically that, but I've seen artists walk out if they walk into a room and technical specs can probably be the deal breaker.
Yeah.
But again, both sides typically know, unless the club is lying. You know what you're up against before the band loads in. I mean, that's why these are provided, right? And you go over it line by line with the tour manager, and you say, do you really need, you know, four bottles of Gatorade at room temperature? Was that right? Is that not a typo? You want to drink Gatorade at room temperature? That's okay. You know what I mean? You just try to cross them off the list, though.
Right. But occasionally, don't you run into someone who, you know, knowing that these tour riders can be really kind of absurdist, just wants to have some fun with it? I mean, Iggy Pop and the Stooges, their tour rider, their technical tour rider, requested, quote, "One monitor man who speaks English and is not afraid of death."
Give me a danger, little stranger, and I'll give you a fee. Give me a danger, little stranger, and I'll feel your disease. There's nothing in my dream, just some ugly
This is an excerpt from the tour rider from the Brooklyn band Parquet Courts. They also recently played in our venue, the Green Space. This is what they requested. I'm going to read it just straight off the page for you. One bottle of communion-grade red wine. One bottle of white wine that would impress your average non-wine-drinking American. One bottle of lower middle shelf whiskey, cheap but still implies rugged masculinity. Mixers for aforementioned mid-level whiskey of slightly higher quality than the whiskey. A quantity of herbal mood enhancer. One copy of newspaper with the most interesting headline, front page picture, comic section, must feature Curtis.
I love that band. I failed to mention that back in the Bell House days, I do remember someone requesting a golden kitten.
A golden kitten.
As you know, we went out and found a gold kitten in Chinatown. Now, it wasn't alive. It was, you know, a gold kitten. But I think they were testing us.
Okay.
And they were so happy to see it backstage.
Now, you can find a lot of these tour riders at smokinggun.com and elsewhere on the net. Now, we were talking before about the famous Van Halen tour rider and this apparently crazy demand that no brown M&Ms are allowed back in the green room. You need all these bags of M&Ms, but the brown ones all have to be taken out. It sounds silly, but here's, again, let's go back to Freakonomics and their host, Stephen Dubner, for perhaps an explanation of that.
So, why did Van Halen require that the brown M&Ms, dark brown and light brown, be removed from the M&M bowl in their backstage munchies? Was it nothing more than rock star excess, or perhaps a clever way of finding out some information that would otherwise be hard to find? Remember, at the time, Van Halen put on one of the most ambitious live rock shows of anyone. Could be dangerous. You didn't want a light tower falling on you or the stage collapsing under the weight of all that gear. To that end, the band had to trust that the local promoter in each city took seriously the contract rider that listed all the technical requirements for this massive stage show.
Promoters frequently didn't read the contract rider, and we would have structural physical issues because, hey, there wasn't the proper electricity, load-bearing stress, etc.
So David Lee Roth, as he explains in a 2012 video, claims that he came up with a trick, kind of like King Solomon's trick, to figure out if a promoter had read the rider carefully.
If I came backstage, having been one of the architects of this lighting and staging design, and I saw brown M&Ms on the catering table, then guaranteed the promoter had not read the contract rider, and we had to do a serious line check, because frequently we had danger issues.
Jack, does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, at the club level and a big production like that, a lot of things can fall through the cracks. And you just want to be confident as a band going into a venue that everything has been taken care of.
And
so it's important. Load in to load out is a very, very important thing.
And as you've said several times, you as the person working at the venue, you're going to check off each line. You're going to check off line by line, make sure that what's done is what needs to be done.
Absolutely.
All right, folks, you can listen to the whole episode of Freakonomics Radio and find out why David Lee Roth was surprisingly King Solomon-like. You can find a link on our website, soundcheck.org. We've been talking about tour riders, how to get smarter about them and kind of figure out what they are and why they are. And Jack McFadden, talent buyer for Austin City Limits Live and the concert venue The Belmont in Austin, Texas, has been walking us through it. Jack, this has been very educational and entertaining as well. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, John.
Week-long series about getting smart continues tomorrow when we find out how to be smarter about Jay-Z. Don't forget, we want to hear from you. What do you wish you were smarter about? You can call us at 866-939-1612 or leave a comment at soundcheck.org. That number again, 866-939-1612 or comment at soundcheck.org. Up next, a new book aims to debunk the myth of the lone genius and instead examine the creative power of duos. We'll talk about some famous musical examples next on Soundcheck.
Hi, my name's Craig. I'm from Fairfield, Connecticut. The first album I bought with my own money was the CD for Pretty in Pink.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Mandolin player Chris Thiele, pianist Vijay Iyer, cellist Elisa Weilerstein, all musicians who've received what's known as the Genius Grant, or a MacArthur Fellowship, in the past few years. The idea of people as geniuses has existed for centuries. single people who stand out for their brilliance or ingenuity in a particular field. But a new book aims to broaden that scope and take a look not at the solitary genius, but at creative pairs. Joshua Wolfshank is the author of that book called Powers of Two, and he joins me here in the studio. Josh, welcome.
Thanks.
So the idea of the creative pair, I mean, I think immediately of John and Paul.
Yeah.
And in fact,
as
your
did
book,
I.
As your book starts with the story of them writing a song together. What is it about John Lennon and Paul McCartney that makes them sort of iconic in this way?
Yeah. Well, there's the work, which, you know, is just now woven into the DNA of our culture. And it's amazing. My 8-year-old nephew a couple years ago put up, the first thing he wanted to put up in his room when he was decorating it was a Beatles poster.
Wow.
So it just goes on and on. And they light up all the themes of creative pairs, starting with their meeting. Paul wandered under the fields behind this church in Liverpool, and he'd heard that there was a band playing. His friend said, come check him out. And he saw this guy on stage. He was doing a Del Viking song, which is classic doo-wop. And he was vamping to the lyrics, making up the lyrics as he went along, and making it into a blues song. And he even used the word penitentiary, which a scholar says that that's not a word that you would use
in England.
In the UK. Yeah. It was like, that's the American South there. And it was really impressed. And then they went across the road, and the Quarrymen had another gig that night, so there was some time to sit around.
This is John Lennon's early band.
That's right. And Paul picked up his guitar and flipped it around. Actually, it's not clear if it was Paul's guitar or someone else's guitar. Anyway, he flipped it around to play it left-handed, which is also super impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And he started doing his thing, and he could do Little Richard perfectly, and he could do Carl Perkins perfectly. He was this perfect mime. He could just inhabit these things, and he knew the lyrics. And even the fact that he knew the Del Viking song lyric and he knew that John was screwing with it was a sign of his mastery. And these guys, the chemistry was palpable. One of the other members of the band said they were circling each other like cats.
Yeah. So, and you write that it's not just that they kind of shared interest and knowledge. They shared a kind of deep subset of knowledge, stuff that most other kids their age in England at that time did not know.
Yeah, both these guys, when Heartbreak Hotel came on the radio, this was life-changing for them. This was like, it opened up their whole world. And they went deep, deep, deep down, each in their own particular way. I mean, John was full of swagger and energy, and he wanted to make things his own. Paul was much more meticulous. So they had these, you know, points of tension from the very beginning, mm-hmm. and this really profound alignment. They were also, you know, both extremely ambitious and wanted to be, you know, big characters in the world, and made themselves so.
So you start off the book, again, it's called Powers of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs. You start off, it's an afternoon in 1967.
Yeah.
And John and Paul are sitting together in Paul's house.
That's right, yeah, in London.
And they are writing a song.
Yeah.
This song. The song is, of course, With a Little Help from My Friends, Ringo singing, but John and Paul have written this song together in Paul's room. And as you tell the story, Josh, Paul has an opening line. You know, Paul has the line, do you believe in love at first sight? But it's not quite right. It doesn't scan properly. And John tweaks it. And
It was the other way that John had this idea that they could begin the verses with a question, or he threw out a question, and Paul said, maybe we could begin every verse that way. Do you believe in love at first sight? And he was like, you know, it's kind of there. It's not quite right. He tried to break it up. It didn't have the right number of syllables. And Paul said, how about, do you believe in a love at first sight? Which is just the tiniest thing.
Yeah.
And but this is it's the tiny things, this tiny exchange out of which, you know, these great works emerge. And the scene, we have really intimate access to the scene because Hunter Davies, who was writing a book about the guys and hung around them a lot, and they really trusted this guy and they let him sit in the studio and watch them work. He was there the whole time. They got together in the afternoon, which was their custom, and they would kind of work through to the early evening or mid-evening when they would go to Abbey Road, and they would often be there all night. And there's this description that Hunter gives of the two of them there in the room just as they got started. They're banging around. John's with his guitar, and Paul is with his piano. And he says, for a couple of hours, they both banged away. Each seemed to be in a trance until the other came up with something good. Then he would pluck it out of a mass of noises and try it himself. So you have this really, to me, you know, spine-tingling sense of two guys who are totally alone and totally together all the while. And that's one of the magical things about a pair, is that it allows for enormous solitude, enormous individuality, and also this possibility of connection. And one of the myths of John and Paul is that when they started spending more time apart in the late 60s, that they were only working apart, and they both actually propagated that myth. But John admitted to, in 1980 to David Sheff, that he was lying when he went way too far on that line in the early 70s, that in fact they were enormously enmeshed, both in the time they spent together and also the way that they were up in each other's heads. They didn't have to be in a room together or even in the same part of London to be affecting each other and competing with each other. So you have, you know, John do Strawberry Fields Forever. Paul came back with Penny Lane. Later, John did Revolution, and Paul came back with Blackbird. And one little geeky thing, since we're on soundcheck, is that if you look at the logs...
Wait, what does that mean, since we're on... Well, what are you saying, Josh?
If there's a place to get Beatle geeky, it's this show. At Mark Lewisohn's logs of the Abbey Road sessions, you could see that they worked on Strawberry Fields for a really long time. They came up with a working cut. 7 days later, Penny Lane appears. You look at Revolution, it's the same thing, and Paul is you know, hugely involved in both of these, quote, John songs. 7 days later, after they finish Revolution, he shows up with Blackbird.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arise.
So they're sort of kicking each other down
exactly.
the road.
Yeah. Yeah, and competing with each other. And Paul would make this motion with his hands kind of like a stepladder. Mm. You know, each one trying to get on top, but they were both getting better. And that really was, you know, George Martin said many times, that was the key to Lennon-McCartney. It was Lennon versus McCartney, but with a lot of love.
You're listening to Soundcheck. My guest is Joshua Wolf Schenk, author of Powers of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs. We lionize the solitary genius, but genius does come in these kind of dyads, you know, these two yeah. artists orbiting each other. Very often, two guys. I mean, Patti Smith and Robert Mapplethorpe, you know, they had a kind of, for a while, a romantic relationship as well as an artistic one. But it seems like most of these relationships are non-romantic. How heavily weighted towards dudes is this thing?
Well, you know, there's a huge missing story in our culture around what women have contributed to creative work, because for so long, you know, there was this expectation that, you know, the wife or the woman on a scene would contribute to her husband's work, and it would take his name, and she was, you know, that was just that was her role, to be totally hidden.
And we would dismiss this with the old phrase, behind every great man, yeah. there's a woman.
Yeah, yeah, which is, you know, I mean, it's a cliche that needs to be dug into, and like, we need to get under the soil of that and actually bring it up, because if you look, for instance, at the story of George Lucas and Marcia Lucas in Star Wars, absolutely critical. The contribution she made, the back and forth, she was the only person when they got into the heart of that who could say, no, George, you know, stand up to him. And there are many specific ideas you can trace to her. She was a very talented film editor.
I was just going to say, she was not just his wife.
That's exactly right. But where is she in the official history of Star Wars? You know, where is she in the popular consciousness? Almost zero. And that is a built-in problem for my book, because so many of these stories have been lost, many of them were never recorded to begin with. Mm-hmm. It's hard to do a proper history, but I hope as we start talking about it that more and more of them will emerge, because it's a really, really important part of the story.
As you tell the story of all these different creative pairs, you know, whether it's in the world of technology or literature or in music, it almost seems inevitable that most of these pairs will at some point fly apart, that the same thing that keeps them together, that tension, will eventually push them apart.
Yeah, it's like, you know, I have these wood candlesticks at home, and at a certain point it burns down, the flame will burn down the fuel of the candle, and it'll get to the wood. You better blow it out before it gets there. And that seems like a good image. I'm the numbskull who often forgets that it burns down to the wood, and it does happen. People do get singed, and that you put it just right, that there's something essential to creativity that involves conflict and energy and two people coming at each other, and it does have a natural lifespan sometimes. Sometimes people really just need a break from each other, mm-hmm. and then they can come back at it. And if you look really carefully at the denouement of John and Paul, that was not a final split. They needed space from each other, and there was an enormous amount of desire that, you know, all the way through the rest of John's life, and moments when it really seemed like they were about to work together again, and the circumstances just didn't come together. There were lots of practical reasons and, of course, emotional reasons why it didn't happen. But when John came back to music in the late 70s, he was not only intending to do this thing he did with Yoko, but to get back together with Paul, and he hoped that George would come along too. They had active plans for that kind of reunion.
So when we talk about the dissolution of these creative pairs, very often there are some kind of external factors. I mean, they're sort of woven into the pair itself. I'm thinking of David Crosby and Graham Nash as an example. You know, David Crosby's drug problem really at some point becomes more than the creative tension can hold together.
Yeah.
And you tell the story, tell the story of what the breaking point for them was.
Yeah, I'll tell the story as they told it to me. It's, you know, it's just the iconic thing that, you know, Nash was and is an extremely patient guy. He loves David, and he loved working with him. They bring out something very unusual in each other, and even though there have been a trio, obviously, and a foursome with Neil Young, those guys really regard each other as, you know, as their primary partner, and they've often done stuff as a duo and contributed to each other's work, solo work. And Crosby, you know, Nash loved that Crosby was the kind of guy who would say "screw you" to the world. He didn't care what other people thought, and he opened him up, and he loosened him up, and Nash had this, you know, the pure, perfect pop structure of those songs. He brought that to the partnership, but Crosby, you know, got really strung out, and Nash put up with it for as long as he could, but there was this disastrous session when they got together, and they were starting to jam, and things were really heating up, and it felt really good. And Crosby had brought his crack pipe into the studio and put it on one of the speakers. And it's like, you know, this big full session jam, mm-hmm. and the speakers are shaking, and the crack pipe is moving closer and closer to the edge, and suddenly it falls over the edge and cracks. Crosby stopped the jam, went over, and starts trying to pick up and put together the pieces of this broken pipe. And Nash says, "That was it. I knew we were done. I couldn't work with this guy anymore," because the way he expresses it is really moving to me, because it wasn't exasperation with Crosby himself, which of course he felt. It was that the music had always been sacred between the two mm-hmm. of them, that they were about something bigger than either one of them, and that if Crosby didn't have faith in that, and he could not serve that, and he could not let the two of them serve it together, well, then Nash was done. But it's also really moving because they tell the story, and you're like, okay, you want to flash forward many years till Crosby was out of rehab. But in fact, if you look at the chronology, there was no getting away from each other. They were too bound up in each other, and it was really only months later that Nash was putting together this No Nukes concert, and he really didn't want to work with Crosby or Stills. He wanted this to be this other thing. And the guys came to him. They said, "Man, we need another act. You know, we need another headliner." And he called them up, and of course, you know, they were on a plane and they did the show.
Well, as you say, you know, the endings of these pairs are often not endings at all. So this break between David Crosby and Graham Nash in the studio, it's 1979. They're trying to work out this song called Barrel of Pain. And a few years later, lo and behold, there's a live recording of that very song. The song is Barrel of Pain, recorded during a 1982 tour, released in 1983 on the album Allies by Crosby, Stills, and Nash. And Josh, you mentioned in the book that even though Stephen Stills is part of the equation, Crosby and Nash really, they considered themselves as a creative partnership.
Yeah, they did and they do. I asked them, many pairs have a private language that evolves organically over time. You know, it starts with little... in, you know, jokes or, you know, little phrases. And I asked the two of them, we were in a hotel room before a CSN gig, and I said, do you guys have a private language? And they were like, oh, yeah, we do. They said, one of them said, well, ask Stephen about that. And the other one said, do not ask Stephen about that. They're, you know, he's a great colleague. They love his work. Mm-hmm. But those guys are bonded in a really, really profound way. And, you know, they show up all through... you know, all through, you know, recent pop history. If you listen to Mexico, it's the two of them in the back, you know, as a, you know, unit. And they even, I saw them not long ago in L.A., and Nash was talking about a record he did. He said it was our first solo album. And he goes, I mean, our first album as just as Crosby and Nash. But that, he said, you know, he caught himself and he recognized that's the way he thinks, that they're one unit.
So is, at the end of the day, is there something specific to the duo that you don't get with when you add a third or a fourth person? Is there a kind of genius that is specific to the duo?
It's an unusual unit, the pair, because it's a social unit and we're social creatures, and we really, to create a reality, we need another person, not necessarily in the room with us, but we need to be in relation in some way with another person, and yet it's immensely fluid and flexible. You can take roles, you can switch roles, you can have solitude, you can have connection. The moment a third person comes in, the dynamic changes, and it can be very helpful. I mean, John and Paul, there's a reason why they had George there too and Ringo there too, and they were something beyond what they could do alone with that third and fourth. But they, as Jeff Emmerich said, who's the engineer, worked for them all those years, he said, the artist was Lennon and McCartney, and George played a critical role, but it was much more of a supportive role. And actually, if you look at the end story, again, everyone wants to know what happened to John and Paul in the end. A lot of what happened is that George, who had been this very stable, supportive presence, kind of doing what needed to be done to polish and dress up this music and had been a journeyman songwriter himself, he got fed up with it. He didn't want to be the little brother anymore. He wanted to do his own work, and he was starting to record, to write and record these, you know, these sublime songs. And that that shifted things so that this constant kind of give and take between John and Paul could no longer had the structure it once had.
So it turns out that genius, you know, it's very difficult to kind of pinpoint it to one person in one place at one time. It is, as you say, a very fluid thing.
And it frustrates our storytelling impulse. You know, that's the reason why you want the hero, because you want to be able to, you know, watch Luke Skywalker and sort of keep your eyes fully trained on him. And you want to watch George Lucas as the hero creator of this story in the same way. But we need to wrestle with this ambiguity, because that's where the truth of creative work lies.
The book is called Powers of Two: Finding the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs. My guest has been Joshua Wolf-Schenck. He is the author of that book, Powers of Two. And Josh, it's been a real pleasure having you with us.
Yeah, so much fun.
On the corner is a banker with a motor car. The little children laughing at him behind his back. And the banker never wears a Mac. In the pouring rain, very strange.
Coming up next, we'll talk with the creative duo behind the band The Rosebuds. Kelly Crisp and Ivan Howard have been making music together for more than 10 years. We'll talk with them about how their collaboration continued during their marriage and after their divorce. That's up next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The Rosebuds are a band that revolves around the creative duo of Ivan Howard and Kelly Crisp. The two started the band in North Carolina a little over 10 years ago. Along the way, they got married. Their 2011 album, Loud Planes Fly Low, chronicled the end of that marriage, a breakup, though, that didn't break up the band. Since then, the two have continued making music together and, in fact, have just released an album called Sand and Silence. Kelly Crisp and Ivan Howard and the rest of the Rosebuds are here in our Soundcheck studio, and they're going to start us off with the title track of the album, Sand and Silence.
I don't understand the sin and silence instead of loving like you want to, of loving like I want to. My heart is pounding again, seeing imperfections instead of what I want to show. Of white, lonely and blue above, but give me a cloud or something right here, 'cause I'm unfolding the light right now, right here. I came a long, long way to see you, and that's all stretched out forever in front of me, and I've even been looking under the tide. See what pulls you back each time, but I ain't found it yet. Sometimes I don't understand the sin in silence instead of loving like you want to, of loving like I want to. My heart is pounding again, see imperfections. I felt like impossible, but I didn't want to trace a line that I already been drawn. I wanted you to see I'd made one of my own. See, I can feel alive, and you can feel alive, and we'll both feel alive. Oh, I could just be here knitted in the river too. Maybe I can have that same feeling pull on me too. Sometimes I don't understand the sin in silence instead of loving like you want to, of loving like I want to.
Some can't you hear instead?
That's the Rosebuds live on Soundcheck with the title track from their most recent album. It's called Sand and Silence. The Rosebuds, Ivan Howard on vocals and guitar, Kelly Crisp at our piano and doing vocals as well, Mark Paulson playing bass and more backing vocals, Brian Weeks on guitar, and Rob Lackey at the drum kit. The Rosebuds here in the Soundcheck studio. Ivan Howard, Kelly Crisp, I am really glad to see you guys again.
Hey.
Thanks. It's been a very
happy
long
to see
time.
You too.
And I'm especially happy because we have been talking a lot about creative pairs, you know, whether it's Lennon and McCartney or Crosby and Nash, and the kind of unique kind of creativity that happens with duos, with pairs. How did the two of you first start working together?
Well, you know, I was in a band, actually. I started out in a band with Brian over mm-hmm. there on guitar. We were in college, and we had all had a big friend group. And one night, a friend of mine said, hey, we have a show tonight, but our opener canceled. And I took that as an opportunity to start another band.
To open for yourself.
Yeah, well, and actually, it was like to open for another band. And so I told Kelly that night, I was like, hey, we're in a band.
We have a show.
These songs.
Yeah, he was like, we're in a band and we have a show tonight. So, and I said, no, I'm not going to do it. And he said, yeah, you are. And you're going to play keyboard. But we were friends. We used to go see bands and listen to music since we were 18 years old. So by that time, we already kind of had we had been friends for a few years and had a good.
And how does the team work? I mean, do you have clearly delineated jobs within the duo?
Well, you know, I kind of come up with a lot of the initial ideas, and I'll run them through Kelly's filter.
I would say Ivan's a songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
Ivan's a songwriter. I mean, that's just his creative calling. And I guess I'm just a sort of good person to
A sounding
encourage.
Board?
Yeah, like a sounding board, but also I love his ideas, and so I'm kind of always been just his fan.
Mm-hmm.
And by this time in the process, it's like I know, like when I write a song, I know what she's going to think about it before I even give it to her. So when I'm doing a Rosebud song, there's like parameters that are preset that her aesthetic is going to match. And so it's uh-huh. kind of guides stuff that way. It's really nice to have that, you know.
You ever just try and screw with Ivan and say, no, I hate that?
Oh, no, no way. No, he would know immediately. He's right. He knows exactly what I think about it.
Yeah, she doesn't screw with me. She just says, no, I hate that.
Yeah, if I say no, I hate it, I mean it.
So, you know, one of the things with a lot of the creative partnerships that we know of, especially in music, is, you know, they tend to be, for the most part, kind of non-romantic. They're completely professional. Now, you guys were married for several years, so was it difficult to kind of delineate the romantic partnership from the creative one?
It was. It all kind of bled together, but it was
It's hard to say because all that stuff is so fluid. You know, you're just like, we have relationships that are, you know, different things at different times, and we were friends before for years, and we're friends again now. And I just feel like that sort of framework gave us a way to communicate with each other creatively, despite all the stuff that was going on,
mm-hmm.
you know, no matter what was going on. Being a couple and then not being a couple, those things changed the dynamic between us, but they didn't change our creative connection.
So somehow, and this is one of the things that Joshua Wolf Schenck in his book Powers of Two talks about, is somehow when these creative partnerships appear to go away, there's still something left, and they often have something that endures, even if it's kind of tough to put your finger on what that is. Are you able to put your finger on what that has enabled this partnership to continue?
I think it's just like mutual respect for each other and respect for what we've brought to this band in the past and our ideas. And I know, like, it would not be the Rosebuds without Kelly, you know.
Well, what does she bring out in you that you wouldn't otherwise be able to do?
Well, I mean,
that was a very Dr. Phil
That's
question.
A really
Sorry
big
about
question.
That.
Tell me what.
Maybe she'll just call BS on me sometimes.
That's like the least of what I do. Like, I never have to do that. He's got such good taste. I think that's the thing, is that we just connect on an aesthetic level where we just have the same kind of taste, and so mm-hmm. we trust each other's feelings about things that in the direction is forward, because we're propelling each other forward. And that's what's important about a creative connection, is that you're always sort of looking at what's in front of you.
Yeah. Ivan Howard and Kelly Crisp and the rest of the Rosebuds are here in the Soundcheck studio. Great song, great songs throughout the record. You're going to play us out with one of my favorites, right? In My Teeth is
the name
of it?
Yeah.
All right, well, guys, it has been a lot of fun having you here with us in the studio today.
Thanks
so much, and enjoy the rest of the tour.
Thanks. All right, appreciate it.
This song is called In My Teeth.
What words
That's the song In My Teeth off of the new record called Sand and Silence from the Rosebuds. You can hear another song recorded by the band here in our studio at soundcheck.org. Tomorrow on the show, our series How to Be Smarter About continues when our regular guest Mario Correa comes in to talk about his major blind spot. It's Jay-Z. We'll attempt to fill in the gaps. And you can fess up and tell us what you wish you were smarter about. Leave us a comment at soundcheck.org. Also tomorrow, we speak with journalist and author John Ronson, who you may know for his books like The Men Who Stare at Goats and The Psychopath Test. His latest project is a movie called Frank, and it's based on his own real-life experiences with the unusual British performance artist known as Frank Sidebottom. If you've seen a movie poster of a guy with a big papier-mâché head, that's the one. We'll talk to John Ronson tomorrow. Plus, Danish singer-songwriter Agnes Obel stops by our studio to play songs from her beautiful recent album called Aventine. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.